Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Hope your day's off to a good start despite all the limitations that we're living under, and hopefully you and your family members and friends are all staying healthy. Governor Newsom is expected at his new news conference today, which you'll hear live on KPCC, to order all beaches and state parks closed starting tomorrow. That after beaches like Newport were full of people last Saturday with a very warm weekend. The president of the California Police Chiefs Association, Eric Nunez, said a memo was sent to the group's members yesterday, giving them time to plan ahead of the governor's expected announcement today. The governor has not responded with comment, but we should know in a couple of hours if he in fact issues that order, which is controversial. Cities like Newport Beach considered an emergency order that would have closed the beaches. Instead, the city council there decided to close parking lots and to enforce physical distancing between those who were at the beach, but not to close the beach. Up in Humboldt County, which is near the Oregon border, Sheriff William Hansel said he wouldn't enforce such an order. He said it's not okay to punish Northern California for Southern California's mistake, and I hope the governor hears that loud and clear. So you've clearly got a conflict brewing over this, and we'll be talking about that next hour on Air Talk here on KPCC. Also later this hour, we'll talk with Los Angeles County's Chief Executive Officer, Sachi Hamai. We'll find out from her about what she's dealing with instead of her retirement that she was supposed to start after a very long career in county government. But we begin with the latest on COVID-19 medically with Dr. Dean Blumberg, professor of medicine and chief of pediatric infectious diseases at UC Davis Children's Hospital in Sacramento. Dr. Blumberg, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Larry.
Appreciate it. Let's start first with some promising news from a clinical trial on the drug remdesivir, which is apparently showing some promise for shortening the length of a person's recovery from COVID-19. What do you see as positive here, and what do you caution from the results of this study?
Well, it was a relatively small study. It had about 1,000 patients in it, but that's still relatively small. And we don't have all the details from it, but the patients who did receive remdesivir did have a quicker recovery. They recovered about 30% faster than the group that did not receive remdesivir. So that's progress. What we didn't see in this study is any results indicating that there was a survival advantage receiving this medication, or that patients had less severe courses, such as requiring less intubation or requiring less time in the ICU or on ventilators. So it's incremental progress. That's great. We look forward to seeing more.
And is there any inference you can take that if it hastens recovery, that it would likely, even if we don't see it in fact, that it would likely lead to fewer people on ventilators?
Well, we would hope so, but we really need to see that data. Another study was just released yesterday also that showed that that it didn't really have, the drug had little effect in terms of viral concentrations in patients who are receiving it. You would hope that it would be inhibiting viral replication, have a lower viral load in patients, and then that would lead to them clinically improving. So there's still a lot of questions with this medication, but it's nice to have some good news.
So this is delivered via IV. And explain just a little bit what the drug, it's believed it does to potentially shorten the length of recovery.
Yeah, so it's an antiviral drug that was originally developed to be a treatment for Ebola. It turned out to not be very effective for Ebola, but it does have other broad antiviral properties. And so when this novel coronavirus was discovered, several antiviral drugs were tested against it in the lab, and the remdesivir appeared to be very effective, along with the other drugs that we've all heard about that have been tried, like chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine, Kaletra and others. But the proof comes when you actually study it in humans and patients to see if it actually does work. And so some of these turn out to be very promising in the lab, and they don't work so well in humans. And so we've seen the early results with chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine that it appears to show that the side effects of these drugs outweigh any benefit that patients may be having. So they don't look like they're very good treatments. So it's nice to get some good news with the remdesivir.
Let's talk about potential vaccines at Oxford University. The Jensen Research Center there is working on a vaccine that apparently is just starting clinical trials on humans this week in Europe. And the pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca is joining with Oxford on this. Oxford researchers are, you know, very positive, as you'd expect they would be at this point. But what the team there says is they think that by June or July, they'll know whether they've got something here. Your thoughts about that optimistic time frame?
I think by June or July, they'll have preliminary results. And so what they'll do is the patients who are receiving the vaccine today, it takes about 2 to 4 weeks to measure that initial immune response. So if that looks promising, then they'll go on and decide that they've got a good dose, a good vaccine, and they'll do more widespread testing to make sure that it's safe in a larger number of people, and then continue to follow the patients who've been vaccinated to make sure that the immune response is durable, that it's long-lasting, that it doesn't go away after just a few weeks. So I think by June or July, they should have those preliminary results. But of course, we'll need a lot more testing before we have widespread use in the general population. We're planning on giving this vaccine to everybody. And so the standards that we're going to set to make sure that it's safe and effective are extraordinarily high. The last thing we want to do is have a vaccine come out that has unanticipated side effects or that doesn't work well, because we don't want people losing confidence in it.
Pfizer also is teaming with the German-based biotech company to work on a possible vaccine. They apparently are beginning a human trial in Germany. So there are a number of these that are underway, apparently. And are you aware of any that have begun human trials here in the U.S.?
Yeah, there was a trial with a messenger RNA vaccine that first started in March. And so they have started trials in the U.S. I think all these studies look at very similar things. The people have seen the picture of the coronavirus with the spikes that come out, and the vaccines, as far as I'm aware, most of them include that spike, and that's an attachment factor to the respiratory tract cells in humans. So if we can have a good immune response to that spike, then we can presumably prevent infection. One of the exciting things about the Oxford approach is that they created this platform for vaccines years ago in anticipation of having a novel infectious agent, so that they could just plug the important part of the coronavirus into this platform and then rapidly scale up production. And so it's these kind of forward-thinking measures that are so important, and that we need to support these public health measures so that we can be prepared to scale up in a time of crisis.
We're talking with UC Davis Children's Hospital Professor of Medicine, Dr. Dean Blumberg. He's also the Chief of Pediatric Infectious Diseases at UC Davis Children's. If you have questions for him about COVID-19 and public health measures to contain the virus, we're at 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPECC. When you talk about possible side effects or a vaccine doing more harm than good once it's in the wider population, is that almost an infinite list of potential risks? Or for the type of vaccine that's being worked on here, are there like a top two or three concerns that you would have when it comes to side effects?
Well, the most common side effects from any vaccine are going to be pain, soreness, swelling at the injection site. And of course, those can be easily managed, and most of those go away within a few days. none of the vaccines that I'm aware of are live vaccines. They're all inactivated vaccines or subunit vaccines. The live vaccines, of course, we would have concerns that they might multiply more than we would want them to. We try to weaken them, but what if they aren't weak enough? Then they could actually cause disease. So I'm not aware of anybody using that live vaccine approach, so we wouldn't have those concerns.
All right, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Los Angeles County residents now have COVID-19 tests available to determine if there's active infection without having to have symptoms of it. So what sort of benefit is derived from an epidemiological perspective in having this kind of widespread test availability?
Well, one thing that we don't know is the amount of asymptomatic infection that's out there. We know that some patients may be pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic and then transmit to others. And this is really scary, of course, because then the whole idea of isolating sick people to prevent infection will only prevent so much infection, and then the asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic people could still transmit. So getting an idea of how many people are out there, you know, what proportion of the population might be potentially infectious and be without any fever or cough, that would be useful information to know.
So would you encourage people to get tested even if they don't see any way that they would be exposed, and if they don't have any symptoms, just that there would be an epidemiological benefit in that?
There would be. I would encourage people to get tested if they would like to get tested, though, because, of course, we also want to encourage people to stay isolated, and so going out to a testing site gets them out and about. And then the other issue is that the test is it's uncomfortable. And many people are not going to appreciate it. The swab that's inserted is pretty long, and it goes all the way to the back of the throat, through the nose and back through the back of the throat. And so it's quite uncomfortable.
We also probably want to make sure that testing centers don't immediately get overwhelmed. So we want to make sure they have the capacity to handle this expansion. We're talking with Dr. Dean Blumberg of UC Davis Children's Hospital. We're at 866-893 KPECC, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Joaquin writes on the page, "I haven't seen evidence walking outdoors is a significant transmission risk. Walking past someone, a park, a beach, or trail seems safe. So why is Governor Newsom anti-science," as Joaquin puts it? Dr. Blumberg?
Well, I think being outdoors does decrease transmission compared to being in contact with people indoors. Of course, outdoors, there's all that air's out there, and that dilutes any virus that's out there. So that does a great job of preventing infection. But if people are close to each other outdoors, then you still will get transmission. So the whole idea is not to have crowds of people. The social distancing is still important. Making sure that people are 6 feet away from each other is the primary means of decreasing infection. The masks provide some benefit, but not as much as the social distancing. But we do want to avoid large crowds of people who are crowded together.
And this is the problem they had at Newport Beach last Saturday, as there were so many people there. They were not able to effectively social distance. Not everybody was masked. And so, that's the problem is, yes, you're outside, but as you're saying, Dr. Blumberg, people are on top of each other and there's the possibility for transmission.
Right. So people need to, when they are outdoors, they need to be responsible about that. So if you're on a hiking trail, when you pass somebody, you need to wait until you can, the trail's wide enough, for example, so that you can have that 6 foot distance around them.
We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Getting back to widespread testing, there are false positives and particularly false negatives, right? Because sometimes the swab doesn't make contact with virus that might actually be there. So how do you factor in inaccuracy to this from an epidemiological standpoint?
Well, we don't think, I think that there can be false negatives. We don't think that there are false positives with routine laboratory procedures. The false negative rate, I think, has been overblown. The test that's being done is extraordinarily sensitive. Of course, you can have a bad sample, or maybe the sample wasn't processed correctly on the way back to the lab. But the test is the tests that are being used, the nasal swab tests, most of them are more than 99% sensitive. And so if somebody is asymptomatic and they have a negative test, that's very believable. If somebody is symptomatic, if you really suspect that they have infection, then it's worth retesting because maybe that first test was negative.
866-893-KPECC. Renee says when Jonas Salk developed the polio vaccine, he didn't take out a patent on it. The vaccine was low in cost, widely available. Renee says she's worried Big Pharma will try to profiteer on any new COVID-19 vaccine, driving up the cost and limit access for the poor. One of the things that AstraZeneca said is that they would provide, if this Oxford vaccine proves to be effective and safe, that they would do it at cost. Now, who knows how they determine what is at cost, but something like this, I would presume, Dr. Blumberg, everybody is going to be covered for this. You're not going to have an issue where people who don't have means aren't able to get a vaccine.
Yeah, that's what I would anticipate. I mean, just imagine, you know, what a bad look that would be for a company to finally get a vaccine and then make it so pricey that people couldn't afford it. I mean, that would be a terrible publicity for them. So I think just the threat of bad publicity will make sure that these vaccines will be safe, will be affordable, that the government is going to make sure that insurance companies cover them. When Ebola was a concern in 2013, 2014 with the outbreak in West Africa, many companies rushed to develop Ebola vaccines, and the most promising one was finally FDA approved just last year. That one's licensed to Merck, and they're making sure that it's being made affordable and is reaching the areas that are needed. Currently, the outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. These vaccines are made available through WHO, through Gavi, and through other organizations to make sure that they are affordable where they're needed.
We'll continue our conversation with UC Davis Children's Medical Center, Children's Hospital, Chief of Pediatric Infectious Diseases, Dean Blumberg. Dr. Blumberg's also professor of medicine at UC Davis. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC on smart speakers throughout Southern California and worldwide, as well as internationally on the KPECC app. We'll be back in just 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC and the KPECC app. We're talking with UC Davis Children's Hospital Professor of Medicine and Chief of Pediatric Infectious Diseases, Dr. Dean Blumberg. Since we're talking about testing, Lori in West LA would like a little bit of an explanation again about the differences between the test for active COVID-19, which is the nasal swab, the uncomfortable sample collection you were just talking about, Dr. Blumberg, and the blood test, which is used to determine antibodies for someone who's been exposed to COVID-19 and has recovered. Can you walk us through the difference?
Yeah, so the nasal swab, most of the nasal swab tests are done with PCR assays. So that's polymerase chain reaction, and they detect the viral genome, the RNA that makes up the virus. And so that's generally associated with active infection. So the virus is replicating, and that's why you can detect it. So that's what those nasal swabs are detecting. So that's usually with active infection. The blood test is different. That's not directly detecting the virus. Instead, the blood test is detecting the body's immune response to the virus. So if you've had infection in the past, then your immune system in fighting off the infection has developed antibodies against the virus. And so it detects the antibodies. there's two kinds of antibodies that normally these tests are detecting. One of them develops very quickly after infection, even as early as 3 to 5 days after infection. That's the IgM test. And then that usually goes away by 4 to 6 weeks later. So if there's detection of IgM, it's meant you've had a recent infection. The other one is the IgG antibody. That one's longer lasting. That one sometimes takes 2 to 4 weeks to develop. And then once that develops and you can detect it, it means you've had infection in the more recent past. And what we don't know about these tests is once you get that IgG antibody, that long-term developing antibody, does that indicate that you're protected against infection in the future? We don't know that yet.
All right. And I'm assuming there's no way to ethically do a trial of that. You'd have to do something that is controlled following people over time, as opposed to intentionally exposing someone with the IgG antibody to see if they get it again.
Yeah, I would agree with that because it would be different if we had if we knew that we had a safe and effective therapy, so that if we exposed people and they ended up getting infected, we could just treat them and they would be okay. So, yeah, I don't think that would be ethical, but this would be a good study that you could do in animal models.
All right. Dr. Dean Blumberg, UC Davis Children's Hospital, with us. Manny in Santa Ana asks about supplements. So many supplements are touting themselves as immune system boosters that could potentially protect against COVID-19. Vitamin C is one Manny asks about. Your thoughts on whether adding supplements to one's diet would have any benefit?
You know, most people in the U.S. Eat a relatively balanced diet and are not deficient in any vitamin or mineral. And so most people in the U.S. don't need to take any supplements, and they don't do any good. It's patients in other parts of the world, for example, who might be vitamin A deficient. They can benefit from vitamin A or other things in their diet that they might be missing. But eating a well-balanced diet, even people who don't do that in this country, still don't really derive any benefit from these supplements or vitamins.
Angela asks on the page, how reliable is the throat/mouth swab test compared to the nasal swab test we've been talking about?
Yeah, there's another test that's a more rapid test, and that one appears to be less sensitive compared to the nasal swab. The nasal swab is a very long swab. That's the one that's done for the PCR assay in hospital laboratories. Another test is more of a nasal swab, so it's a shorter test, or sometimes they just do an oral swab or a saliva test. And that's a more rapid test that can be done at the bedside or even in the doctor's office or in the emergency room. That one can miss about 20% of cases. So if it's positive, it's probably reliable. But if it's negative, you're still not sure because you might be missing a fifth of the cases.
All right. Christine in Monterey Park says, I think there's a lot of confusion over whether the virus is airborne. Does it just spread through highly contagious droplets? And are our current precautions sufficient for the airborne risk?
Yeah, there is confusion, and I think the reason for that confusion is we just don't know with 100% certainty. So we think that the primary route of transmission is through the respiratory droplets, and those are the large droplets that generally only stay in the air for about 3 to 6 feet, and then since they're large, gravity takes over and they end up on the ground, and that's why we have those recommendations for the social distancing for 6 feet. But it does appear that some people can aerosolize the virus, too, into smaller particles that can stay airborne for longer periods of time and may travel longer distances. These are likely not as infectious, but we think that might, in a minority of cases, result in some transmission.
And would that have to be from a cough or a sneeze, something to eject it out to the distance you're talking about?
No, that can even be just with yawning or even just talking. It can aerosolize the virus. And so that's why we want to make sure as an extra safety measure to protect people is that if you're sick, that you would have a large concentration of virus, that you should stay home and self-isolate. But right now we're not recommending additional measures such as I've seen people say we should be 12 feet away from each other or other measures. And I think we could do that, but you know that's even more difficult to do, and people are already burdened by the current restrictions we do have in place.
Rough Seas writes on the AirTalk page, since the current virus belongs to a family of SARS viruses, what's the possibility of developing a vaccine effective against the common characteristics of that family in anticipation of future variations or mutations?
Well, that would be great. I'd put that on the back burner for now. Right now, we need to develop a vaccine for this virus. And again, the major vaccine approaches have been to look at the spike protein. There's some variability in the spike protein with different coronaviruses. So the spike protein is different with this SARS-2 compared to SARS-1 in 2002-2003. And so we're not sure if the same vaccine would work against all coronaviruses. But these viruses probably do have other commonalities that are less variable, and that should be looked at too. And for example, with influenza vaccines, right now the influenza vaccines are developed against specific strains. But there is research into looking at universal influenza vaccines that would protect against all influenza viruses and hopefully would result in a robust immune response that maybe you could get a vaccination every 10 years or so, and you wouldn't need to get a vaccine as the virus drifts and changes.
Wow, wouldn't that be great? And the cost benefit of that, as well as the human protection, be remarkable. David in Redondo Beach says, with the uncertainty as to whether the antibodies provide protection from reinfection, could it be as simple as finding out from those who are sick with COVID-19 whether this is their first or second bout with it? Is that information routinely collected, Dr. Blumberg?
No, I'm not aware that it's routinely collected right now. It would be interesting to note. And it's also possible that the antibody itself isn't what's protecting against infection. That's just easier for us to measure. But that may correlate with other markers of infection, such as cell-mediated immunity. And so many viruses, the major protective factor in our immune system is not the antibodies, but their individual cells, lymphocytes, that protect against infection. So the antibody itself may not be protecting. It may just be a marker that we've had a robust immune response to the infection.
Dr. Blumberg, I want to thank you not just for speaking so eloquently to all these questions that we've asked you so far today, but also for coming on with us with very little notice this morning. Our physician who was scheduled to join us had a hospital matter that had to be dealt with, and we really appreciate your being so kind to, on short notice, join us today.
Great. Well, thank you for getting the word out. And I know there's a lot of confusing issues with this, so it's nice to try to clear things up.
We appreciate it. And you've done that. Thank you. Dr. Dean Blumberg, UC Davis Children's Hospital Professor of Medicine and Chief of Pediatric Infectious Diseases. It's been great to see how physicians with incredibly busy schedules have cleared them to join us when one of our physicians had an emergency at the hospital to deal with. It's great. Every day we've been able to bring you a top physician or epidemiological specialist to answer your questions. You're listening to AirTalk on KPCC.